For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Welcome, Bodhisattvas. So, some of us have been hanging out here since a little earlier this morning, and we're having a day-long retreat exploring the samadhi of Prajna Paramita, the mother of all Buddhas. So I thought we could just continue on in that vein. Has been said that at the moment of awakening, Shakyamuni Buddha exclaimed, "Wonder of wonders, all living beings are truly enlightened and shine with the wisdom and virtue of all the Buddhas, but because their minds are deluded and turned inward to the self-centered ego, they fail to understand this." So there's some practice instructions here. So maybe we want to study delusion and how this happens, that we turn towards a self-centered ego, and that this covers our bright shining light, or at least our ability to see it. So I think the studying of the mind is an interesting sub-project of Buddhist meditation, studying the mind stream. This is one of the things that we do in stillness. I don't know about you, but thinking does not seem to cease, at least for more than a very brief period of time, which is probably a good thing, otherwise we'd be dead. These questions of studying the mind, you know, what are the qualities and functions of our minds that support awakening and compassion, that support the complete, unobstructed shining of our wisdom and virtue? Conversely, what are the qualities of our mind, body, and hearts that lead in another direction towards confusion, greed, hatred, divisiveness, self-centered ego? So in studying these everyday mind activities, this is what is known as following the stream of our delusion, right down to the bottom, and then having it come in flower as the lotus of awakening. Actually, the images of Prajnaparamita are, in one hand, she holds a sutra, possibly some version of the Heart Sutra. I guess she's advertising her own book, right? Prajnaparamita scripture, advertised by Prajnaparamita. And in the other hand, is a lotus. So these are some hints, some nice images. So this whole project of our zazen, of our Buddhist meditation, is to somehow clear away all obstructions and shine completely our wisdom beacons. And after calming down a little bit, we can shine this deepest wisdom, which is sometimes called prajna. And one way to think about prajna is pra is before, and that nya part, it's a hard thing to say for someone of my native English speaker, not a native Sanskrit speaker in this lifetime, is knowledge, kind of everyday knowledge. So before that, the time of precog, or this is also known as resting in the moment before thought arises. So that's something you can do in your zazen. But this prajna arises and is expressed as compassion. That's the enacted form of our deepest knowing before we think we know that we know it. Before our minds start doing what they do, which is slice and dice reality. So reality comes along. If you look around, we're already slicing, dicing, you know. There's Jane, there's Paula, there's Tom, there's Jason, there's someone I don't know, there's someone I do know, there's a man, there's a woman, this person is this and that, the floor, you know. So our minds are these slicing and dicing machines, you know. Maybe there's like some advertisement on some late night TV for that. But this is what our minds do. So there's wholeness in this world, that we're all functioning together in this giant cosmic pond, this cosmic ecosystem that extends in an inconceivable way throughout space and time, as we're told in the scriptures of Buddha. And our human brains are just like slicing and dicing machines. We chop that up. That's sometimes known as delusion. And when we add this kind of fixed idea of self to it, that becomes this turning inward towards the self-centered ego. But don't be too hard on yourselves for having one of those, because they're sort of our natural pets, which probably live beyond us. So we have to care for them well. So this prajna paramita affirms the interconnectedness of all things, and this light frees us from illusion, the darkness of delusion, as it said. But this belief that we're separate self nuggets, you know, these individual self units, you know, is cannot be underestimated, my friends. That's kind of a basic automatic function of cognition. In an earlier incarnation in this lifetime, I was a social psychologist in addition to a clinical psychologist. And although some people, some Buddhists, probably others, are kind of afraid, like psychology is going to pollute Buddhism. But I actually think Buddha was like one of the original psychologists, you know. So I'm not afraid. I started studying psychology because I felt it supported Buddhist practice. And Buddha studied the mind and experience, and the first thing that occurred that he to his consciousness was wonder. Wonderful, wonderful. Ah, I see how the mind works. Delusion keeps us separate. Ow. Let's study that. So I think we can think about some things that psychologists study that help us get unstuck from separation. If we understand and start to study how separation occurs. And right now in our social world, there seems to be a painful tangle of separation and polarization, largely fueled by stereotypes. And a stereotype is a subcategory of delusion. And I've thrown out all my old textbooks on social cognition, so I went to Wikipedia to find a definition of stereotypes, and here's a good one that I thought was fine. It's a widely held but fixed and oversimplified image or idea of a particular type of person or thing. So I think the Buddha was onto something long before the social cogs came about. Fixed and oversimplified image. Sounds a little like delusion. defilements, kleshas, taints, nivaranas, coverings, all these words that some of you Buddhaphiles may be familiar with. But these kind of ideas that I think I know who Douglas is. And then I kill Douglas. So I don't want to do that. But I think that it does happen. Once, a very famous Zen teacher said to me, "Lori, if I start to have ideas about what it is to be a Zen priest," this is also a trainer of priests, many priests, he said, "watch out, get out of my way until I get over that problem." So stereotypes are these specific ideas, right? And they encourage separation and prejudice. If you think you don't have, does anybody think you don't have a stereotype? Good. So you can confess that to yourselves. And so study that. You know, somehow at some point in our development, the sorting hat comes out. Like, do you know that sorting hat from Harry Potter? You know, where like, then you're placed in Gryffindor or Slytherin. And the minute that happens, you're this and that, you know, or you're Lannister or Targaryen or something like that. You know, I'm in this crowd and you're in that crowd. And of course, we want to be in the in crowd. You know, I'm in the in crowd. So then we have our in crowds. And these are good and those are bad. Okay, this is the slicing and dicing and how it starts to work. When stereotype views start to morph into oppression, which they do, they become, it's another good Wikipedia quote, justifications of ill-founded prejudices or ignorances. Buddha taught freedom from ignorance. So I think Buddha's teaching freedom from stereotypes. They lead to unwillingness to rethink one's attitudes and behavior. And all the work that social psychologists have done, they have found that it's extremely difficult to change people's minds. So when you're sitting in Zazen, sometimes difficulty arises. But when you get off your cushion and you deal with another person or being, that's amplified because these views become activated, right? So And there's a deep unwillingness to let go of these. This is also, I think, something about the biology of the brain, you know. And I think probably amoebas and dolphins and whales and, you know, all sorts of things have this issue of once they get a pattern going, it's very difficult to modify that. And if you think reading the Prajnaparamita scripture is difficult, try applying that to your mind. This is a difficult practice we're in. Another thing that I think happens with these stereotypes is they also, in their most pernicious form, and in one that might be circulating at this time in our world system called endurance. Our world system from Buddhist perspective is endurance. So we kind of have a tough time. That these stereotypes can lead to violence and hatred of the other. Right? So there's always an other, you know. In America, it was Japanese Buddhists during World War II. Let's round up the other, do something to them, get them out of our way. We don't want them around. Today, take your pick. So we're in a difficult situation, bodhisattvas. Our minds are stacked against us. Our brains are wired to create suffering and distress in the world. So fortunately, I think that Buddha's awakening, this is a deep realization that we're going to need a lot of help and a variety of techniques to escape the problematic tendencies of our minds. So carefully attending to his own mind stream while sitting, Buddha realized wonder. And I think there's wonder is at the heart of awakening. You know, in the text that I began with today that said wonder of wonders were the first words uttered by Buddha upon their awakening. Sometimes that's just like, how wonderful. But wonder is a practice, you could say, or something to cultivate as we sit to open our hearts and access our light without obstruction. So I'm just encouraging you perhaps at some point to devote yourself to this practice of wonder. And on one hand, we have this tendency to slice and dice. And on the other hand, we have this world of prajna that we can't know. And at the threshold of that is wonder. Ah, how wonderful. Oh, there's actually a story I heard that wonder counteracts stereotypes. That when you tell stories that counter people's ideas about how other groups of people might should be, and they see them as wonderful, that's one way to melt stereotypes. It's a very difficult thing. So I heard that President Obama started telling stories of people like from different groups, such as people known as Muslims, that counteracted this idea that someone who belongs to that group is some dangerous terrorist, and had people write these into the speeches to help people counteract stereotypes. So wonder can be this kind of quality that transforms or dissolves rigid stereotypic thinking. Because if you try to persuade someone, social psychology says if you try to persuade someone out of their beliefs, it doesn't work. It actually makes the belief stronger. So there is this quality and wonder of invitation and connectedness and communion that is a ceasing of judgment and separation. So that's kind of the backdrop. Prajna, compassion, that world, threshold, wonder, delusion. So there's this access point. Sometimes this is called the mysterious pivot. Those of you who are sutra and koan aficionados, this pivot where we want to rest in zazen. However, here's an example that I heard on a podcast called Snap Judgment. If anybody ever heard of this podcast, Snap Judgment, it's a great name. It's the story of a rabbi and a dragon. Anybody ever hear this story? So this is a story of Rabbi Weiser, like Weiser. What a name, right? Rabbi Prajna, and not so funny, a grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. So I'm just condensing a short podcast, so hopefully I won't lay too much on you, and I take full responsibility for any distortion of content. But I like this story because I think it talks about how having some wonder is healing. So Rabbi Weiser and his family moved to Lincoln, Nebraska to lead the local Jewish congregation. And soon they were welcome with phone messages. This was back in the day when people had answering machines. You click the button and something would, maybe people know what these are. Younger people, I guess you have to listen sometimes to voicemail, although it's kind of annoying, right, when you get a voicemail. Like, why is that? It must be my mother or grandmother. But anyway, in this day and age, not that long ago, the Weiser family would come home and turn on their answering machine, and all of a sudden these messages started coming from some unknown individual saying things that were quite threatening and frightening, like, you'll be sorry you ever moved to that house, Jew boy, among other things, some worse that I won't even try to repeat. And they were frightened. They went to the police, and the police were like, just be careful, keep your eyes open. That was not very comforting to them, I think. They received a package of KKK material with racist and threatening comments and content, ugly brochures. And Rabbi Weiser was like, I better wonder who this is. Better find out. And found out that this was probably, the likely suspect was the local KKK Grand Dragon. And this dragon's name was Larry Trapp. So you have Mr. Weiser and Mr. Trapp, but trapped. And Rabbi Michael got his phone number. So Michael Weiser is this guy's name. And after listening to the recorded message, which you call a dragon up, and it's like, you've received this is a KKK. If you'd like to join, please leave a message. And then it was followed by a diatribe against Asian people. And after the beep, Rabbi Weiser started a practice of leaving love notes, such as, Larry, there's a lot of love out there. Don't you want some? Once Larry picked up the phone and says, stop calling me. And Rabbi Weiser said, I heard that you're disabled, and I thought you might need a ride to the grocery store. And Mr. Trapp, Grand Dragon Trapp, declined that offer. But at some point, the rabbi gets a phone call from the dragon, and the voice says, I want to get out of what I am doing, and I don't know how. And Rabbi Weiser said, would you like to talk about it? And Dragon Trap said, yes, I would. So without hesitation, the rabbi and his wife get into the car, go to the local chicken shack, and come over to Larry's house to break bread. So he said, we went to the house to break bread. They get to the house, and Larry Trapp is sitting in his wheelchair, armed with weapons, and the rabbi extends his hand, and Larry takes the hand and says, take these away. They've caused me nothing but trouble in my whole life. And in his hands were his two large KKK insignia'd rings. And Larry took the rings. I mean, Rabbi Trapp. No separation. Rabbi Weiser took the rings. And they had a long conversation. And they became friends. And Larry quit the KKK and actually began to heal from this. But he was also a very physically sick man, a double amputee. And he couldn't take care of himself very well. And eventually, he moved into the Weiser home. And the rabbi's wife quit her job to care for him until he died. So, although we have these concepts of prajna and delusion, they seem very far. But this is how this all works in the world. And it comes from this willingness to accept an invitation to step into a threshold of not knowing. Sometimes this working of wonder in the world we call sitting in the midst of flames or extending your hand to an armed grand dragon of the KKK. And as the story goes, thus stereotypes were resolved and wonder brought forth, prajna as awakened compassion. So, things don't always seem to turn out this way, but if there's a chance that they do, if there's a chance that there's some healing, we have to be very still and calm and patient and able to enter this place of how wonderful I see the light in everything that arises. So I wish that for all of us, that we help each other bring forth that and turn away from the self-centered ego towards the light, through studying our everyday mind and stereotypes and prejudice and difficulty and polarization, and allow our mind to slice and dice but not be fooled by it. So thank you for listening to me. And I'd love to listen to you.
fear being a hindrance. And it's amazing to me when someone could let go of their fear, the kind of transformation that could take place. And there is the wonder and awe is in that transformation. Mm-hmm.
If we wonder what it's like. So wonder doesn't have a quality of fear, which is a pulling back, but that's right, a hindrance. Without any hindrance, there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, there realizes complete unobstructed shining. And of course, study the fear. Follow it down to the source. And open up to reality. Thank you. So how will our Qigong help with this? Paula's going to lead us in a session of Qigong. She is a grandmaster.
Not a grandmaster.
A master. A martial artist. And later on, if you were here in our little session today, our little retreat, but we work with our energy in Zazen, right?
Yes, we do.
So there must be some way that Qi is working to release us from fear in our bodies.
In a quick response, Qigong helps us realize or let go of our fragmentation. Like you're saying, we categorize and cut and dice and slice and all this stuff. So at the most basic level, through connecting with the breath, the body opens more, and when the body opens more, we realize that we don't need to cut, dice, slice, and categorize as much. So I'd say right from there, connect to a larger state where anything is possible. It could form in any way.
It's okay to slice and dice if we're in the kitchen. But anything is possible. Yes, Chris.
Thank you very much for your talk. The story about the rabbi and the member of the clan reminded me that I've been listening to all of these podcasts looking into the Lotus Sutra and looking up the reminder story told about the Buddha and Devadatta. Going to be a Buddha someday, and despite this, attempts to take the Buddha's life all these various times. So the first time, Devadatta hires an assassin to go and kill the Buddha, and the assassin shows up, and the Buddha is meditating, and he just breaks down and can't kill him because it's so beautiful and profound. And later, I guess there's some sort of, they described it as like a wily coyote kind of situation with him trying to push a boulder on the Buddha, and it like wounds him, but he's not killed. And then later again, he tries to kill him, like a big elephant or something, and the Buddha, in his compassion, manages to calm the elephant. But despite all of these attempts on the Buddha's life, and still, treats him with total compassion and says, you will be a Buddha someday. So just this incredible capacity for love when taking a sort of expansive view that is sort of independent of actions that you could judge as so forth, you know, good or bad, in the present. Just like being able to look beyond that and still tell, you know, everyone else, you know, I love you. Mm-hmm. Even if they're trying to literally kill you. Mm-hmm. They also invoked Martin Luther King Jr. about his approach to forgiveness. Mm. It's an active practice. That it's not something that but anyway, just that, you know, regardless of the actions being done, that it's something that has to be expansive and all-inclusive. And that, you know, even when the churches were being bombed and they were being mm-hmm. attacked in the streets, mm-hmm. still to say, I love you, you will mm-hmm. be with them someday. Despite all that, I think it's, mm-hmm. I think it's marvelous.
Yeah, so that's the Lotus of the Wondrous, Wonderful Dharma Sutra that you're quoting, right? So,
familiar actually with the Lotus Sutra.
Yeah, Miao, wonder. I think in Chinese maybe it's Miao. Wonder has this wondrous, it has this meaning of being subtle and mysterious, but this place where everything is possible. And yeah, that's typical Buddhist practice. Or Jimi Hendrix said, with the power of love, everything is possible. And some good guitar work on top of that. But yeah. Dave. Keep practicing. It said practice 10 years, practice another 10 years, then sisazen another 10 years. So I actually started Zen practice specifically out of social activism because I became very concerned that I wasn't ready to help people. And I'm not yet ready. So it is absolutely true that Rabbi Weiser could have been killed in that situation, and this story would be told in a different way. But we can't know that. We can't know. So we have to live in this world of wonder. So you might wonder, well, I wonder, this might not be the right time for me to, like, do this. And I think that it's a very good question. Thank you for pointing that out, because I would never want anyone to think that I'm thinking, oh, just go put yourself in harm's way and all the world will be just fine. Because the world is just fine. It's just that we have a difficult time seeing it. So be yourself fully. That self that extends beyond your conceivable idea of yourself. But if a bus comes, please step out of the way. So thank you for that very much, Dave. Yes, hello.
Just going off of just fine, one thing I've been struggling with is kind of like, I don't know, coming from like white man privilege tradition, like just fine for me seems kind of passive, taking a just fine stance.
Follow the trouble. If you're having trouble, take it seriously and follow the trouble. Follow the trouble, sit with the trouble, study the trouble, open to the trouble, open to the difficulty, the dis-ease, patiently until something else arises. We can't escape. Like, all of these conditions are our lives. There's nothing wrong with that on some level. It's just that sometimes our conditioning, it makes it very hard for us to sit still long enough with it to tolerate the pain of it. But you're not alone. So, don't turn away from it. Thank you. Keep wondering about that, the risk management program.
Yeah, what do we do with the risk?
Risk. Risk. Lack of safety? Is that what you mean?
Maybe, yeah. There's no guarantees to anything.
That's right. Right, so in the place of wonder, there is no guarantees. That is inconceivability. That is imagination beyond imagination. So we don't know. So yeah, there is risk. The minute we're born, there's this risk we're going to die. And it's about 100% as far as I can tell. So watch how we want to escape it. Watch what risk brings to us. Like if risk is like, oh, it's fear. I'll explore the fear until it settles and then you know. Or you have a chance of knowing. You know, many of you know my favorite image in Zen is this drawing by Hakuin. It's a single brush stroke of a log bridge between two mountains, and there's a giant chasm that's a drop-off. And on it are two what appear to be blind, monk-like individuals with canes extended, crossing this single long bridge in single file. So this is our life. There's a lot of risk to fall over the edge and tapping it slowly with all beings with us. And also, you know, sometimes you fall over the edge. And we are sad. Our hearts are sad when someone dies or when there's hurt. Yeah. But it's risky business, yeah. Suzanne, hello.
When you're talking about that and risk and everything, you realize that, like, in our delusion, we're kind of putting blinders up to the idea that there's risk. And we're creating this delusion that things are a particular way that isn't. Mm-hmm. Privilege shows up. It's this image that we have of reality. It's a little slice, it's a little piece. So, like, the risk is there all along. The rest of reality has been there all along. It's just trying to remove the line that says, wake up, or away. And we can't possibly do that to absolutely every element of reality all the time, or we feel a function. Like, so there's this, I mean, we can, in some ways, but in the particular, we can't hold every single and harm and hurt and risk and danger and all that, like, that's there, so it's trying to find a way to manage that, I guess, and to not put up such huge blinders on walls and divisions that we're not seeing more, but also needing to, that, and there's certain discernment that we have to do.
All right, absolutely.
To be able to open the door, to be able to, you know, whatever.
Yes.
And so where's the, you know, just practicing with discernment in ways that aren't cutting so much that we cause harm.
And be willing to know that we can't know whether we're causing harm or not. So, careful. This is why this practice takes a long time. This is why people say, I want to have complete, unsurpassed, perfect enlightenment. And not to say that lightly. So it, molecule by molecule, the thought arises of separation, of privilege, of blah, 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 you know, danger, risk, you know, chopping, Slytherins, you know, all this stuff. Meet it with a certain mind, and that mind is expressed in your body. But we can't have the algorithm for it. Maybe AI can, I don't know, Buddha's AI. But it's true, that's your wish, it's a strong wish. I want to be rid of this, and I want to act in a way that heals the world. That's what we all want, or we wouldn't be here. That's actually what everyone actually wants. And it's a big project. So thank you for taking it on. So that blinder, be with it, with patience, it was zazen mind, with compassion, take the feedback from the environment and your friends. And slowly, 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 it's transformed. Or at least check it out. And sometimes wonder is like, ah, wow, I wonder if that, how big that blind spot is. Or somebody points it out and you're like, oh, thank you, that was really wonderful. You just showed me how rigid I am. Maybe I could soften just a little with your love. Dave, were you going to say something, please?
Thinking about Aisha's question about risk management. In that story, the rabbi story, I think maybe one of the crucial moments is that the rabbi didn't just like show up unannounced at this guy's house with groceries and say, like, hey, you know, what are your best friends?
Right.
You know, I love you, let's be friends. He first attempted to open a door with calling and saying, can I do this?
Mm-hmm.
And that was refused, and then later got a call back saying, like, can you please come over? So I think that's a really crucial part of the wisdom of what I did was, and I think that's maybe part of the key, kind of what you're saying, Susanna, about opening doors, is maybe part of that risk management isn't showing up like a superhero for everything.
Right.
But being ready to open doors for miracles to happen, for wonder to happen, and then waiting, being ready for when it meets you,
right,
showing up to it.
Yes, that's wonderful. So it was like, would you like to talk about it? There's an offering. So in some ways, our life is a complete offering. That's the lotus, is an open offering. And somebody might be like, I don't like that offering. You're like, okay, thank you very much. It's here if you'd like it. But I'm not going to shove it down your throat. You know, and to know that, to be like, would you like some love? Nope, not today. Okay. And that might hurt you. You might be like, oh, but I love everyone so much, I want to share it with everyone. And of course we feel that way. But also sometimes sharing is being like, okay, and I'm going to delete that racist message on my phone because I don't want to hear it. You know, so there are ways. So that's the wisdom, that's the working, that's compassion as a flowering of prajna.
Mm-hmm. And also, the rabbi didn't contact him first. The dragon was the first contact.
That's right. Good, yes, part. Very good point.
And about the wonder. Because if someone reaches out in any way they do, they usually are expecting a rigid response. Like, they think they know how you're going to respond. And that's where that openness and skillful means and reflection comes in. But the rabbi didn't initiate the relationship.
Jason, our great work leader, who cleaned the temple in a miraculous way.
Well, that was not me. That was other people, too.
Yeah. So the entire universe cleaned this temple before our retreat. So thank you very much. And you would like to say something. Thank you.
Yes, I would. Specifically, your comment about that the dragon was the one that initiated that. I don't know if it's true for Shaolin or Kung Fu, but I know with sword fighting and other sorts of martial arts, it's typically where it's often described that the person who makes the first move loses. So there's great samurai movies from the 50s where they're just standing in the field for like 3 hours. and the first one to move always loses. So it's a very potent image, especially when it came out of your mouth. I just thought of you standing, waving, to make your move.
Mm-hmm. There's also inquiry and response comes up together. So nobody loses in Buddha's game. But when you're dealing with an embattled situation, like KKK who hates a certain group and a member of that organization, then maybe that first move thing is kind of a cool practice, right? But that invitation, wait for the invitation.
I think that it's helpful also to think about the example of Avalokiteshvara, sort of deep listening. It's a very, in many ways, a very reactive thing, but also a very active thing. And not necessarily imposing yourself into the world and disrupting things, but rather being just very, very aware of the sounds, of the cries of the world, and then using the awareness of what the conditions are to figure out how can I operate within these conditions? And just being, getting outside of yourself and seeing what's actually going on, I think can be very clarifying how one can respond to that. Just becoming one with it and really knowing what there is that's out there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you for reminding me of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, clearly saw the interconnectedness of all things and the lack of self nuggets. How do you watch without the eye? These are the blind monks crossing. These are the blind monks crossing the precipice.
Yeah, right.
That the eye is gone. I mean, it's the eye, but it's the eye. Right.
Yeah.
Right. But I say, please don't just rip the eye out, but study and transform the eye until it flows into the river of compassion. There's this idea we want to get rid of all that and all of our delusion. And I say, soften to it, open to it, relax with it, don't act it out. Until your pet is just slipping, sitting in your lap and goes, I smell how to help this situation. Thank you. You smell better than I do, so that's helpful. So watch, smell, taste, touch without the eye. It's a great text. Hope somebody sends me one like that. So bodhisattvas, have we exhausted our need to speak for today and supported each other nicely? So thank you all very much.